Hello and welcome to the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast, a Scottish FA podcast that hopes to help clubs at all levels of the game with marketing advice, tips and insight. The podcast is hosted by myself, Michael Bockel, and Sports Marketing Scotland's Chris Sampson. For the first podcast of 2021, we were joined by Heart of Midlothian Chief Exec Andrew McKinley as we found out more about what goes on behind the scenes at the Edinburgh Club, Andrew's approach and a look at life post-COVID. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast. This is our first podcast of 2021, but it's far too late in the month for me to be saying Happy New Year. So I'll just say hello, Michael. How are you?
Hello, Chris. All good, thank you. How are you?
Good, yeah. Good to be chatting again and get the podcast underway for this year.
It is. We've been talking about it enough, so we thought we'd better get into action.
No, definitely. We do have a great episode lined up today with Heart of Midlothian's Chief Executive, Andrew McKinley. Andrew, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Chris. Looking forward to it.
Definitely, we are too. Let's just get cracked right into it then. Can you give us a bit of your background in sport and your current role at Hearts?
Yeah, of course. I came into sport in 2012. Prior to that, I'd spent my career as a lawyer, both in private practice and in house with the Clydesdale Bank, and then came into the SFA in 2012. And 2012, for those that can remember back, was a fairly eventful year, as most years are in Scottish football. But it was a very eventful year with everything happening around Rangers in particular that year. And my first couple of years, actually, a lot of what I was involved in was around clubs who had financial issues, and one of those happened to be Hearts, actually, back at the time. So I was involved right back at that period when Hearts went into administration, and and watched them coming out of administration when Anne Budge took over. So it's fascinating for me now to be at the other end of that. Had 6 years at the SFA. Which thoroughly enjoyed, and as I left, I was interim chief executive for a short period, just as Stuart Regan had left. And as I say, thoroughly enjoyed almost my whole time there. It had its stresses and strains, as you can imagine, but it was great. And then went to Scottish Golf as a chief executive for a couple of years, a very, very different environment, and again, in the main, enjoyed it, but I'm really happy to be back into football, where I think I feel more relaxed, if that's the right word, but certainly feel happier in that environment. So it's great.
What about your current role then? You've been in it for around 6 months, I think, now. How have you found it, and what's it like on a day-to-day?
Yeah, I've really loved it. I mean, it's great. As I've said there, it's great being back in football. You know, great being with a club like Hearts, big club, huge opportunity. You know, in many ways, obviously, the club went through a difficult summer, we all know we won't go over that again as we find ourselves in the Championship. But that's an interesting time for me to come in, because we are looking to, it's not a rebuild job, not in the same way as it was at all when Anne came in. A lot of the things we're done and put in place, and they're still there. It's just making sure that we can get ourselves back up and get ourselves positioned for going forward. But I guess the thing that's been hardest in the first 6 months, no doubt, has been the COVID side of things, and I haven't been able to see probably the majority of the team or the staff other than through Zoom meetings. So it's not been ideal, but it's been what it's been, and it's like that for everyone. So it has been a good time to come in and really to understand a bit more about the breadth of the club and what the club does, whilst not being at Tynecastle very often, unfortunately.
We'll touch on COVID a bit later on. But, I mean, how have you approached then that need to get up to speed with all aspects of the club? As you said, you're having to do a lot of that remotely versus sort of obviously trying to hit the ground running.
Yeah, I mean, it has been hard not getting to meet people in person. I guess the first 2 months that I was in, there was still no football, although we were preparing for the Championship starting again in October. But what that allowed me then was to really get, I guess, under the bonnet of all the other sides of the club, that, and a lot of these things are things that, you know, I guess people take for granted and don't maybe know they all of them exist. So really to understand a bit more about the work we do in the community, but also to understand the other things we do from an income perspective. So what our retail offering is, what our hospitality offering is. I'm sure many don't realise that we run a restaurant, which we're really proud of the fact that it's now listed, the Skyline Restaurant's now listed as one on TripAdvisor in Edinburgh. And we provide catering to two other venues as well. So really getting to understand those, which are businesses in their own right. Other things that we wanted to do, which we've managed to do in that first 6 months, are we've obviously, it was important, both Anne and I were keen to bring in a new sporting director, and you know that had been a bit stop start for various reasons, but we've managed to do that, which is great, and that's been really helpful as we've come into the second transfer window since I've been at the club. We obviously got off to a good start in the league, and we won a very important cup semi-final against Hibs, which just reminded people of where we are in Scottish football, and I'm probably still coming to terms with the end of the final. Although to be fair, there was probably only about 10 or 15 seconds where I allowed myself to think that we might actually win it. But it was still a hard one to take at the end of the day. So yeah, it's when you reflect back on that 6 months, you actually think, you know, there's quite a lot happened in a short period of time, but it's I'm thoroughly enjoying it. And, just looking forward to going on to the next side of things.
As you've mentioned, Andrew, you joined during lockdown, and Michael said we'll come on to a few specifics around coronavirus and that side of things later on too. But after getting up to speed with everything, what was the immediate priority for you in your role? What did you identify that to be?
For me personally, the immediate priority was to make sure that I had a good working relationship with Anne. Anne had been chief executive and chair since she had come into the club, and therefore this was the first time that she had taken a step back and brought in an external chief executive. And I mean, although I know Anne and I've known Anne for several years, I've not worked this closely with her, obviously, and we had a lot of discussions about this prior to me actually coming into the club. But it's been great, and working with her for her is a fantastic thing, and it's really, you know, I can still learn a huge amount from her, and we've got a good understanding of, you know, what areas that she leaves me to get on with, and where she's involved in things as well, and that was my main priority. Other than that, as you'd expect, the main priority for all clubs at the moment has just been to look at financially where we are and how we're going to make sure we can come out the other side of this difficult time in as good a position as possible.
You mentioned obviously working with Anne and getting up to speed there. Has your perception of the club changed now that you're part of it all?
I think probably has to some extent. I mean, I always knew Hearts were a big club, but I think the main thing for me that's been not a revelation, but it's been really eye-opening is, you know, the work done and some of the things I've already touched upon that I maybe wasn't aware of. And I think probably the biggest thing is just the understanding how important and loyal the fans are to the club, and how amazing they've been over the last number of years. And yet again, when we went through a difficult period over the last 6 or so months, they just stood up to the plate. And you know, many of them will have had their own issues during that time, and yet they've just shown their incredible loyalty. And I think the other thing is, and I know how important all clubs are in Scotland to their surrounding communities, but to really get an understanding of how important Hearts are to its community has been something that's you know, not changed my perception, but gives me a greater understanding and perception of the club.
I think just rewinding a little bit, after your 2 years at Scottish Golf, obviously coming from my perspective as attempting to cover Scottish sport as a whole, was there anything you took from there that you've brought forward into your return to football?
I mean, there's always bits and pieces that you bring from any job into another job. Probably the biggest one for me, and it touches upon actually what I said a minute ago with my relationship with Anne, but is just how important the relationship with the board and with the chair is for the chief executive, and a clear understanding of demarcation of responsibilities. I think that's something that I did learn from Scottish Golf. Other things, and I know we'll maybe touch upon it later, just around some of the things that were challenges for Scottish Golf, which are similar for football. There are some similarities, but also it is very different, because I'm within football. I've always been involved largely at the professional level of the game, although at the SFA that obviously goes right through the game. Whereas in golf, it was entirely about the amateur game and entirely about the participation side of things and getting more people involved in golf. So it was very different. But yeah, there's no doubt there'll be things, and some of them I might not even realise at the moment, that I will learn from that I'll bring back into football.
You mentioned it there about obviously Hearts role and the surrounding community, the fans and that whole sort of connection. We talk a lot about club identity on the podcast. Where do you think Hearts sits then within the role within the community and what potential identity is, as what they stand for as a club?
Yeah, no, identity is a really, really interesting one. And there's sort of, three things that I would immediately talk about around this. I mean, I sort of think to myself about what's the first thing one thinks of when someone mentions Hearts. And certainly to me, it was always, or would always have been, Tynecastle and Tynecastle Park, and you know how important that is as a community hub within Gorgie, which is one of the most deprived areas in Edinburgh. And you know, I always think Tynecastle is famed for being that sort of intimidating atmosphere from a football perspective, and players like to play there. And the crowd really get behind the team, and the number of times you've seen the crowd really get, you know, will that team on to win is incredible. But it's the wider piece around Tynecastle. It's that fact that it is part of that hub within Gorgie, and you know, the community piece is huge. It's huge with so many clubs, which I totally understand. And you know, like many clubs, we've done a lot of things that others have done as well around, certainly during the pandemic, working with Social Bite to provide meals to less privileged, and also we've been involved, and we'll be involved again with the fans fitness piece with the SPFL. But there are a few other things that we've done which I think are fairly unique. So for example, in 2019, we launched an innovation centre within Tynecastle. And we did that in conjunction with Bailey Gifford and Dell Technologies. And what we do there is we work in partnership with sort of learning providers, with schools and businesses. And we use that power of football and our unique position in the community to attract and motivate young people of all ages to acquire skills for the digital economy, which is obviously a major thing going forward. Other things we do through that is work and provide support for aspiring entrepreneurs and for those looking to expand their own small businesses and help out with employability. And again, in conjunction with Dell during the recent period, and I think other clubs might have done this as well, but where we look at the whole homeschooling issue and the fact that there are so many people that don't have the tools at home to properly do remote schooling, we've helped out with the provision of laptops, etc., for those that maybe don't have the required tools to do the homeschooling properly. The whole mental health piece, again, I know a lot of clubs have been involved in this, and that's something that we certainly have done a lot of. to help out with those that have issues. And again, that's been a big issue over the last 6 months, as we all know. So just checking in with older supporters, etc., to see how they are. I think the other thing I would touch upon, the sort of third thing, you know, after Tynecastle and the community, the third thing I would touch upon that's very much part of the identity of Hearts is its heritage. Hearts is very proud of its heritage, and rightly so. And I think one of the things that's very closely associated with Hearts in that respect is in particular around the First World War and the McCrae's Battalion. And, you know, that's something that the club will always remember. Remembrance time is a very important time for the club. And as you may be aware, again, we've used Tynecastle during the festival in Edinburgh a couple of times to put on plays which commemorate the whole McCrae's Battalion and the First World War. So, again, as with many clubs, that whole heritage piece is very, very important and plays a key part in the whole Memories project, which I think has been one of the huge successes in Scottish football over the last few years, to bring in older people who have memory issues and to effectively revive them by, for a short period of time, by showing them videos and pictures of things that they'll remember from their younger days in relation to the club. So that's maybe I've said quite a few bits and pieces there, but that's what I feel the identity of Hearts is.
No, it's quite interesting as well. As you said, you cover sort of three different areas there, and I think I would probably could have guessed two of them, but to hear more about that work in the community, for example, and the sort of lengths that Hearts are going to strengthen that ties with there and the support that's given is pretty impressive. I mean, one of the things I suppose, looking from the outside into Hearts, is I've always found that the club and the fans have had quite, especially recently, I suppose more than anything, but quite a strong connection and bond. Do you think because of all the work between the club and obviously the Hearts Foundation and that fan towards fan ownership, it's brought that sort of additional level of connection?
Yeah, I do. There's no doubt about that. As we move towards fan ownership, which will happen or should happen this year, it will bring it closer. But we won't, or we shouldn't see any great differences from a day-to-day running of the club perspective. What I would say though is about the fans from the wider sense is, and I'll come back to the foundation in a minute, but in the wider sense, you know, we still during this season, we have 11,500 season ticket holders, and you know the vast majority of them have agreed that effectively all they're going to get for this season is the right to watch Hearts on TV, and you know that's a phenomenal number of people that are prepared to do that, but they realise how important their money is to the club. The foundation, I guess, just to give a sense of the size of what they've done for the club, and put it in some context. I know this week that, you know, Dundee United have talked about how I think their fans have given them £60,000 to help them out, which is fantastic. To put it in a little bit of context, over the last period of time since the foundation was set up, as of last month, they've now contributed £11,264,000 to the club. Every month they give the club in excess of £100,000. And in fact, during the last summer, on several months, we received £151,000 every month from them. So I just don't think people maybe appreciate the level of contribution that the fans have given to Hearts and continue to give to Hearts. It is quite phenomenal. And I don't think it's matched probably by any other club, certainly in Scotland, not in that direct money that comes in to the club. So it's something that we do not take for granted, but it just shows that huge link with the fan base that we have.
Yeah, that relationship and that link, as you say, is unbelievably strong, and not just in that financial terms, but as Michael was kind of linking to as well, it goes much kind of deeper than that. How important do you think it is that Scottish clubs have the fans at the heart of everything they do? And kind of coming back to that last point around that connection with Hearts fans and the foundation of Hearts and Hearts, the football club as well, what's being done to maximise it and strengthen it even more than it already is?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things we do and we tie in with the fans to make sure that we understand what their issues are. I mean, don't get me wrong, with social media and the power of social media, it's impossible really not to know what the views of many fans are. And although, as you know, with social media, a lot of it can be on the more negative side of things. So it's important that you understand some of the positives that fans are thinking as well. We have meetings, regular meetings, with a group called the G10, which has been around for a number of years, and it effectively is made up of the main fan groups of the club, and we talk to them to understand what their issues are. We also always have someone that attends the foundation board meetings, again just to help with the communication between the club and the fans. And I think there's a number of things that we've done around that whole piece, to be very open with the fans. And I know we'll touch upon that a bit more shortly. But I don't think you can ever communicate too much with the fans. They want to know what's going on within the club. It's their club. And it quite literally will become their club very shortly. And, you know, they just want to understand as much as possible about what's happening within the club. And they want to know that those that are the custodians of the club at any time are working in the best interests of the club. Because let's face it, they've had years where I'm sure they feel that some of the custodians didn't have the best interests of the club at heart. So there's no doubt that whole fan club thing, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's been accentuated hugely, obviously, over the last year as to how important fans are within the stadium. For those of us that have been fortunate enough to attend football games, it really is a surreal atmosphere sitting in a stadium when there's no one or hardly anyone there. It's utterly bizarre. And what you don't get when you're in the stadium, which you get when you're watching on TV, like it or not, is that sort of crowd noise piece. Although we do actually play some crowd noise at Tynecastle, it's far from the same. And it is just bizarre, but it just shows yet again how the fans are and always will be an integral part of the game in Scotland. There's no doubt about it.
You mentioned it at the start of the last answer there, but fan feedback, as you said, it's difficult to get away from it sometimes if you're on social media. How does that work then in terms of bringing that to the club and kind of official channels? Is it directed through the Foundation of Hearts representative on the board? How's that kind of presented back to you at the club?
No, I mean, there are two FOH reps on the board, and I wouldn't. Yeah, we get a report from them at the board meeting, but it's much more, you know, we have informal links with them all the time, to be honest with you. And there are many channels that we interact with our fans. We also always respond to any correspondence we get. We will always go back to it, good or bad, as long as the person tells us who they are. And it's not abusive, obviously. But yeah, we're always prepared and happy to take the feedback of the fans, because at the end of the day, they're all that really matters. They're our customers, and we need to understand what their thoughts are. I think what you've got to be very careful with when you're a director of a football club is that you don't knee jerk in the sense of, you know, fans understandably go from very high to very low, and we've seen that at Hearts in the last week. So last Saturday, we had a very poor performance at Tynecastle. We were 3-0 down to Raith, as everyone knows. And it wasn't acceptable. But we know it wasn't acceptable. But by goodness, did our fans let us know about it. Whereas Tuesday night, we go to Starks Park and we win 4-0, and it could have been a lot more. And, you know, the fans are then on top of the world. So you've got to be careful when you're actually involved in the running of the club that you, it's not that you don't listen to that, but you need to tread a more moderate in-between line than go from the extreme highs to the extreme lows. Otherwise, you would be making crazy decisions every day. So absolutely crucial to take the fans' feedback and especially where it's constructive feedback about things that they'd like to see improved, etc. But you can't always give them what they want every day, and especially when you look on social media. I mean, unless we were signing a new player every 5 minutes, then there's going to be an element of the fans that are not happy with what we're doing. But they are the club, they are the customers, and therefore it's hugely important that we understand what they want.
I think one thing for Michael and I, we've mentioned Hearts quite a lot in kind of our examples and when we're referencing clubs that do things well. But from your perspective, what do you think the club does well in regards to marketing and the media side of things?
Yeah, again, a lot of what I might say here, I'm sure other clubs would say the same, but where I think we do well is a lot of our behind-the-scenes content. We do work very closely with the manager, the coaching staff and the team. Just yesterday, we put on it's the second part of a new series that we're doing called Up in Gorgie, and we did that with the Robbie and his two members of the first team coaching staff, and it was great, and it gave an insight into what they are thinking. As a club, I think we would say we are very open, and we try and be as open as possible, and I think that's borne out by over the years, the last few years, some of the statements from Anne as the chairman. You know, the detail of those statements, I think, has been something that's probably never been seen before from a chairman in Scottish football, but the fans love the detail, and it probably is quite unusual for clubs to be so open, but Anne firmly believes that we should be as open as we possibly can be. And I guess a good example of that would be, you know, that led to us agreeing to do the Inside Tynecastle TV programme, which I think was very well received. Again, it gave a huge insight into probably something I touched upon earlier on in the breadth of what happens at a club and what goes on behind the scenes. I think for those of us that aren't involved in football, we are maybe, you know, understandably, we don't think about, we just think it's, you turn up on a Saturday, you watch your team, and then the team go away again, train a bit, come back next Saturday, and that's as simple as that. But there's a huge amount of work goes in behind the scenes at clubs to make that all work and to do all the other things that we do. And I think that was one of the major things that came out from that documentary. So yeah, that whole openness piece, and it's something I think we want to keep doing and make sure that we are open and give fans as much access as possible to what's going on at the club is crucial to us.
Andrew, then, with your approach with everything and talk about the openness, and obviously Chris just asked there about the marketing media teams, are you a person that likes to get involved in everything, or are you happy to let your teams get on with it?
Very much the latter. My personal view is that the role of the chief exec is a simple one. What do I mean by that? I mean that it's not my job to do other people's jobs. It's my job to make sure that I bring in the best people or have the best people around me to do their jobs. And my role is to make sure that they are empowered and enabled in such a way that they can do their jobs to the max. I think if I did their jobs for them, the club, well, one, I would fall over pretty quickly, but secondly, I'm not sure that would be at all the best for the club. Having said all of that, and it's vitally important, I am ultimately accountable for everything that they do, and therefore I need to have an understanding of what they're doing, and I need to make sure I'm involved where they want me to be involved, and to support them and, you know, support the decisions that they make, and let them make their own decisions, but always be supportive of them, whether those are right or wrong decisions. So, yeah, that's definitely the way I like to work. It's the way I think that a chief exec should work, but others may have different views on that. I mean, it makes, sometimes I'm sure the team think, what am I doing if I'm not doing the stuff that they're doing? But as I say, I think the most important thing is to support them and let them get on with their day-to-day jobs and give them the tools to do that to the best of their abilities.
That completely makes sense as an approach. And I suppose before we go on then to talk a bit about current situation, coronavirus, one thing I wanted to pick up on, because you mentioned it at the very start, was about your Skyline restaurant and you know, it's ranking so high in TripAdvisor with reviews, and just understanding a bit more there about that proposition and what actually you do offer at Tynecastle and why that has been a focus for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, when we came out of the first lockdown, and I think this is going back to July time, was when hospitality was first allowed to open up again. Now, I joined the month after that, but I was doing a bit of work with Hearts prior to that during the summer. And one of the things I was asked to get involved in and help with was with our head of hospitality, Graham, who's fantastic at what he does, but to help him with that reopening. And, you know, we obviously have all the match day hospitality, which we do, but we have in the main stand at Tynecastle, if you've been there, it's a fantastic facility, and the top floor in particular has a wonderful view out across the top of Edinburgh, and you can see the castle from there. And so we have a restaurant there which offers fantastic food at very reasonable prices, as you'd expect me to say. And we now use one of the online apps, Open Table, to sell the restaurant, and that's been a real help as well, because previous to that it was just people phoning up, etc. But now having that has made a difference. And where we're particularly successful is things like Sunday lunch side of things and families coming in. And I think the big thing for us is, as you'd expect, in the main most people that came originally were Hearts fans, and a lot of them were men that would come each week and maybe would bring their wives and families along. And Graham certainly talks about the amount of feedback we get, in particular from wives, but maybe from husbands as well, is that, you know, they just thought they were coming to a football stadium, and I don't know whether they were expecting just to be fed pies and Bovril or whatever, but, you know, we're just so impressed that we have a restaurant there which serves fantastic food. And then it becomes word of mouth, and then we've been really, really had some great reviews on TripAdvisor, which saw us climb the TripAdvisor charts very quickly. And, you know, that was all going very well. And then, unfortunately, as with so much of hospitality, we've been hit hard by the various lockdowns and different tiers. Although it was good to note that even when we weren't allowed to serve alcohol and we had to close at 6 o'clock, we still had a good footfall coming through the doors. And, you know, when you're not getting income through the door from football crowds, you do have to look at other ways that you get that income. And this has been very important for us. I think, as I touched upon earlier, it's not just that in-house Skyline restaurant, but we also do the catering for Turnhouse Golf Club, and for Myerside at the rugby ground. So, again, I don't know if other football clubs do that, but we effectively have a catering business, both in-house and to do outsourced catering. And that's just become a very important part of what we offer as Hearts, which, again, most people probably won't know.
Kind of reminds me of, I went to Bilbao last year at the start of the year, and went to San Mames, and it really reminds me of that. Like, they have a kind of a restaurant that is open for as long. I don't know the proper hours, but it's just, you get to go to basically your place of worship as a fan, and you get to have a dining experience. And it's not one that, as you say, it's not just a pie and Bovril on a Saturday. It's the club opening up to its fans on a 7 day. A 7 day basis every day of the week.
Yeah, it does. And the fans like it, and yeah, as you say, the food's great, and it just shows another side of what we can offer. I mean, I think one of the big issues for football clubs generally, especially bigger clubs who have a big footprint like we do, our ground like we do, is that it's too often is it's empty, and you need to look at ways that you can try and use that stadium during the week. And that's some of the community things I touched upon earlier on, but also these more commercial type things as well. I mean, another thing we have within, again, you might not be aware, but within the main stand at Tynecastle, and it was part of the conditions with the council when we rebuilt the main stand, but at one end of the main stand is a school nursery. And so there's a nursery every day. Children come into the nursery, and that's part of Tynecastle as well. So, you know, I think that's some, and we've still got one floor at in the main stand, which is totally undeveloped, the second floor. And that's something that we, not in the immediate because of everything else that's going on at the moment, that's something that we will look to develop as well. And we've got a few ideas of what we might do with that. But getting the most out of the stadium on non-match days is something that's really important to us.
I think it probably, sorry, Michael, just to interrupt it, that probably leads on to one thing I was going to ask as well, and it's kind of related to your time at Scottish Golf too, with like participation and growing that side of the sport. I imagine that having a nursery on kind of campus, as you say, on site, how good is that for attracting future generations of Hearts fans?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think that whole future generations piece is interesting. I mean, the golf piece is, I think most people understand that there's been a massive decline in golf club membership for a good number of years. But what maybe people don't understand is actually the number of people playing golf has not decreased in the same way. It's just how people consume the product that has changed. So people, a lot of people who still play don't want to be members of clubs. And I think golf has just been very slow and still is very slow at picking up and embracing that next generation of golfers. And, you know, and that's what football has to make sure that it doesn't allow to happen, is that it, you know, we are lucky in Scotland that crowd sizes in Scotland over the last number of years have not deteriorated. They're still incredibly healthy. And as we're all very quick to talk about, that we have the highest per capita ratio of support throughout Europe, which is brilliant, except at the moment, obviously, because with that means that's such an important part of our income. And therefore, when you don't have it, the downsides of it are massive. But you're absolutely right. We can't, and I think this is where golf, got it wrong. They were a little bit asleep at the wheel. And we can't afford to be that. We have to look at the demographic of what our crowds are, what the people are that come to Tynecastle, and what can we do, and I'm sure we'll touch upon this a bit more as we keep talking, but what can we do to improve that whole fan engagement and fan experience and really understand what is it that the next generation wants from that fan experience? Because for all there are still those that go to the football that want their pie and Bovril, and we need to cater to them. There are others that would have maybe moved on from that and want a very different experience. And that's you know, that's something that we need to make sure that we're cognizant of as people's demands change going forward.
Do you think then, Andrew, because obviously as things, and I hate to say normal, but things gradually start to get back to what that normal was, and fans are in the grounds and we're seeing fuller grounds, do you expect to see, first off, I suppose, a greater interest in attending matches of fans because of just missing out on all that time of being there? And if so, is it a chance to, as you said, maybe offer something a bit different and start with a bit of a clean slate?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really good question, a really interesting question. I think that we'll have some reluctance from some individuals to come back to football. And it may be some of our older fans. I don't know. I wouldn't want to assume that. But I suspect for a period of time, there'll still be health concerns of people coming into bigger, where there are a lot of people. Even if the ground isn't full, there'll still be, by definition, a lot of people around. And I think we might see a little bit of reluctance there. However, I think this is the overwhelming side of this. As I said earlier, we've got 11,500 season ticket holders, and they cannot wait to get back into the ground. And, you know, for Hearts in particular, our hope and our aspiration is that we'll be coming off the back of a successful season and returning to the Premiership. And you know, that should have a good feel-good factor for when we go forward. I think the other big thing is it's not as if fans have had other things to do when they haven't been at the football. So it's probably in many ways increased, you know, how much they are missing it and how desperate they are to get back. So I actually think we might get a bounce in the initial stage when people get back in. But going back to what I said a minute ago, we cannot be complacent, and we do have to look at, and we are already looking at some things that we can do to improve that fan experience going forward and to make sure that they are still enjoying coming to Tynecastle. I mean, one of the things we're doing at the moment, and it's as good a time as any to do it, is, you know, and this is maybe, I didn't mention this earlier on and maybe should have, but it's quite interesting. My perception of Tynecastle is always, you know, or was, it's very modern stadium, but actually the three stands that are not the main stand have all been there now for between 20 and 30 years. And, you know, they're showing that sign of aging, and there's stuff there that we need to just do to make sure they're maintained properly. And so we are using the next few months before fans get back in, and have been using the last 6 months, just to make sure that, you know, the stadium is ready and is in a good place when the fans get back. Because, you know, it's amazing how quickly stadia, especially when there's no one in them, can deteriorate. The fabric of them can start to deteriorate. So that's a really important thing for us, to make sure that when the fans do come back in, Tynecastle is ready for them and is gleaming for them.
I suppose then that's looking at things in the shorter term. Has the pandemic impacted your longer term plans to a certain extent?
Not so much longer. I mean, I think we were criticised, and this predates me, but you go back to the beginning of the pandemic in March last year, we were criticised as a club for acting very quickly. And, you know, it was well publicised that we were one of the first clubs to make wage cuts. We did not do any wage deferrals. It was all cuts, because to our mind, deferrals was just kicking the issue down the road. And we planned for the worst and hoped for the best. And that is still what we're doing. I mean, at the moment we are finalising, we're almost a month through our H2, but we are reforecasting for a second half of our financial year 2021. And, you know, we're doing that on a fairly conservative basis. And I think we feel 21-22 as a season could be equally as hard. And if you think of that, you know, a lot of the economic impact of COVID is still to come, still to unravel. You know, I've no doubt as furlough schemes and other schemes that are in place are removed, that economic impact is going to be felt heavily on a lot of people. And, you know, it's important then that we do make sure that we are in as good a position for the longer term. But I guess I'll go back to the fact the support of the fans, incredible, remains incredible. The support of our sponsors has also been fantastic. And I think the other thing that definitely cannot go unsaid and is widely reported is that we are very, very fortunate to have significant support from our benefactors, and particularly James Anderson. And, you know, that's massive for us. That's absolutely massive for us. But, you know, we want to, so we can plan ahead, and but we are fortunate in that regard.
You've mentioned sponsors. What are the types of conversations that you've been having with your sponsors, club partners, about the situation and things going forward?
Yeah, we've been working with them very closely. I mean, there's obviously the double whammy for us, in that not only have we got the COVID issues, but going down to the Championship means that, you know, we don't have the same exposure to television, which obviously has an impact on what you can sell to sponsors. We don't have as many games this year. But, you know, the guys in the marketing team and the sales team have worked really hard to come up with different virtual type packages to sell to sponsors. Our existing sponsors have been incredibly loyal. You know, many of them have suffered real difficulties as well, but we've tried to work in partnership with them and help them out where we can, in the hope that, you know, they'll help us out, and they have helped us out in the past and will help us out again in the future. I think it's important to note as well that we've done really well in that, even during these times, as well as working with our current sponsors and in partnership with them, we've brought on some new sponsors. So a couple of very good examples of that would be Carabao, which has been a great sponsorship for us, which has come on board this year, and Mark Darcy as well, for the suits, which has been a great one for us. So it's not just been a time of you know, looking after the current sponsors and partners and working with them, although that's been very important. But, you know, we've also worked hard to bring on new sponsors. We've come up with new packages, new virtual packages, match day, virtual match days, and these sorts of things. And, you know, that's been challenging, but it's been really interesting. And actually, some of the things that we've done, you maybe wouldn't have thought of before, but I wouldn't be surprised if we keep some of them going forward, some of these sort of virtual type things. And so, you know, not everything that's come out of this crisis has been bad. It actually has made us all think in some different ways, and some of those will be things I think that we will still use in the future, which is great.
Where do you sit, Andrew, in terms of the level of marketing investment within Scottish football, particularly at club level? Is that something you've given much consideration to in your role so far at Hearts?
Yeah, I mean, I think everywhere I've been, I remember when I was at the SFA, having been in some budget meetings and some board meetings, there was always a lot of discussion around marketing spend. And, you know, I'm not a marketeer, and I think one of the things that non-marketeers really struggled with was understanding, you know, the return that they got from the marketing spend, and what was the worth of the marketing spend, and really putting a number on that. There's no doubt when you chat to our head of marketing that their view is that we don't spend anywhere near enough on it, and I've never met a marketeer that doesn't think that. And I think it's definitely something we need to make sure that we do spend appropriately. But it is that whole piece about making sure that we're spending those finite resources wisely. I guess just to take it in a slightly different direction, to me, first and foremost, this is talked about a fair bit, but again, it's maybe like many things in Scottish football, it's talked about, and I'm not sure we do much about it. But I think first and foremost, we really need to look at the marketing of Scottish football as a whole, as a product, and how well we market that. We have a dreadful tendency to talk ourselves down as part of the Scottish mentality, and in turn we then have a dreadful way of talking down Scottish football as a product. Now, that's not going to exactly encourage people to come in and sponsor it or become involved in it if we can't even talk it up. So I think that's where we need to start with it, and really need to sort of reassess what is it that we're actually selling and what we're trying to sell, and then make sure we sell it in the most positive light possible.
Would you say that that's one of your, talking about Hearts in particular already at the current time, would you say that's one of your big off-pitch objectives that you'd want to concentrate on over time, just continuing to talk the club up and developing that side of things?
Yeah, I mean, there are probably a few things on the off-pitch that I would look at, I guess, tied into that, and I've touched upon it already as we've talked, is the whole fan engagement, fan experience piece, I think. And that is the whole, you know, what are we marketing here? What are we selling? And the use of IT and digital is just, you know, if you want to encourage the younger people to keep coming, they'll want to interact with the club in different ways. They'll want to use apps. They'll, you know, when they're in the stadium, they'll want to have a digital interaction with the club as well as the actual interaction. And there's no doubt that that's going to be the future. And, you know, you look at some of the things that they do in America with that fan experience. Now, I'm not saying we can replicate what they do at American football or some of the other American events for a number of reasons, but there are definitely things we can do better. I mean, I think other off-pitch objectives, to me, again, I've talked about community, and that remains and will always remain at the heart of what we do and really important going forward, and we'll continue to do that. I think we will see, if I have no doubt, we're going to see changes in the whole broadcasting landscape over the next 5-10 years. What that looks like, I'm not sure we know at the moment, but I'm pretty sure we're going to see changes there, and I think we just have to make sure as a club we are ready for those and best positioned for those. And I guess the other thing just around those changes, and maybe this is slightly more on pitch, but I'm talking about it more generally as a club, is who knows what we're going to see around. You know, there's talks a lot going on all the time. We hear about Atlantic leagues, we hear about European Super Leagues, we hear about various things like that, and I just think, you know, we want to make sure as a club that we are positioned to take advantage of whatever comes down the line, so that we're not left behind in relation to any of those.
Where do you see Hearts Women into the mix for the overall direction of the club going forward as well? Obviously, they had a really successful and recent Kness WPL2 campaign too, but women's football currently falling into the suspension of things too as we're recording this. What about Hearts Women going forward?
It's a good one. I mean, the Hearts women's side, as you're probably aware, it was really only a couple of years back that although the team were called Hearts, it was really only that the club officially took over that women's team a couple of years back, and you're right, they had a fantastic season last year and played half the season this year before suspension, and it's fair to say it's been difficult. It's been very difficult. I think part of that though is because we are seeing a little bit of a split potentially in the women's game. I mean, for years and years it's been Glasgow City that have dominated, but Rangers and Celtic are now throwing a fair bit of money at this, and we're seeing the greater professionalisation of the women's game, and it's going to be interesting as to whether, you know, other clubs like ourselves can match that going forward, and you know, follow what Rangers and these teams have done, because if we're not able to do that, then unfortunately, much like the men's game, we're going to have two teams, maybe three, but two teams that dominate the women's game in the same way as they dominated the men's game, and you know, that would be a shame. So the women's team is a really important part of the club. I mean, we had a very good manager who was taken away by Rangers, and we've now got another great man, Andy Kirk, now in charge of the women. And, you know, we've got a good women's team, but being able to compete with some of these other teams is definitely a challenge for the future. But as we all know, the women's side of the game, in particular over the last 2-3 years with the success of the Scottish women's international team, is thriving in Scotland, and it's something that is an important part of every major football club. There's absolutely no doubt about it.
Just to then, conscious of time, Andrew, when we had Alan Barrows on last year, we asked him a question and thought we'd ask you a similar question. He talked about summer football, but is there anything you'd want to change about Scottish football if you could have a sort of your say would be final sort of thing?
I think I've actually already touched upon it. And the one thing I'd like to change is this constant negativity. We are so bad at constantly coming up with problems and attacking things that are done either at governing body level or at club level or whatever, and everyone thinks they know best, but you very rarely see anyone coming up with a solution. And I think that goes back to what we need to do. And again, I mentioned it a minute ago, is just actually being much clearer about what a great product we have in Scotland, but also what is that product and how do we differentiate it from, you know, we have a really bad tendency to, maybe understandably because they're our next door neighbours, but, you know, comparing ourselves with the English Premier League, and It's just no point in that. It's just ludicrous comparison. So we have to be very clear about what we are and how we can look at what our unique selling points are and how we can best market those to get people interested in Scottish football for what it is. And because it still has, I mean, we all know how important football is to this country, and a good example today, which I've seen online, is how excited Panini are about selling out our sticker albums for the Euros. So it just shows how massive we are as a football loving nation, and we always, or hopefully we always will be. But I just think we just need to be a bit more positive about that fact and not negative. So that's probably the main thing that I would urge everyone to do, and try and come together and work together for the good of the game as a whole, because we will all benefit if we start doing that a little bit more than just looking after our own self-interest.
I think that's the perfect note to end the podcast on, Andrew. I couldn't agree more with you there. Thank you so much for coming on and chatting to Michael and I.
Pleasure. Thanks very much, guys.